I'm Jim Haskell, Senior Portfolio Strategist. Today, I sit down with Co-CIO Bob Prince to talk about some of the key issues he's thinking about pertaining to the evolving macro environment and the implications for investing. We hope you enjoy it. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, Jim.
Before you get into how we think about the current environment, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about where we were before the pandemic.
So before the pandemic, where we were was that we were in the latter stages of the long-term and the short-term debt cycles for the developed world. We were looking at an environment going forward of slow growth, low inflation, near zero interest rates, but with plenty of liquidity. The monetary policy was a weak lever, creating increasing dependence on fiscal policy coordinated with an accommodative monetary policy, what we referred to as MP3. That's the world that we would be heading into. And I'm distinguishing MP3, meaning this joint fiscal and monetary policy, in contrast to what we refer to as MP1, which is an interest rate driven monetary policy, and MP2, which is a QE driven monetary policy. Both of those forms of monetary policy have sort of hit the end of their useful life, with interest rates at zero and or near zero at that time, and QE substantially spent. And so going forward, we were faced with this policy asymmetry, meaning no limit to the amount that central banks could tighten, but very limited in the ability to ease and reverse a downturn. And therefore, as we look forward, not likely to see any preemptive tightening with respect to inflation. But if inflation actually was going to materialize, it would take that to get that sort of tightening. And the overarching goal of policy, and particularly among central bankers, is to keep the expansion going. So that's where we were in January, 10 years into an economic expansion. That's where we were at the time.
Moving from where we were to where we are now, can you describe the key dynamics we're currently facing?
I think the best way to characterize the pandemic is that there are three overarching characteristics to this set of this circumstances. We have a global income shock caused by a pandemic with interest rates at zero, and in particular, long-term interest rates at zero. So the first thing is that this requires a fiscal policy supported by monetary policy, MP3, which is a combination that's not the usual and certainly not available to all countries, much more available to reserve currency countries. That income shock has collapsed spending, which is then reinforcing the collapse in income and threatening a self-reinforcing process that would be very difficult to get out of in normal times, but it's much more difficult when the normal lever for doing so, a big drop in interest rates, is not available. As a result, the downside risk for the economy and the markets is far greater. When you have a downturn, you normally have the natural stabilizer of a decline in interest rates. And at this point, you don't have that net. So the size of the fiscal and monetary response is now sufficient to fill the income and spending gap that we see or that's been created, at least within the United States. But the pathways for that money and credit to sustain income and spending are not assured. I think the biggest risk is a duration mismatch. It's a different kind of duration mismatch than we normally talk about in investing. But this duration mismatch is a time frame mismatch between how long and how deeply the virus impacts income and spending in relation to how much and how long the fiscal and monetary response can last. A difference between those could be devastating. Because if you get a collapse in income and spending that's not offset by the fiscal and monetary response, that's when you fall into the self-reinforcing process that is very, very difficult to get out of. So what I'd like to do is discuss the mechanics at work, both with respect to what's happening in the economy, how that's affecting markets, but then also the policy response and what's really going to be required for that policy response to work. And so just a couple of background pieces. An economy is comprised of transactions of which there are always two sides. There's a buyer, there's a seller. When one person spends, there's income to the other person. When that person gets income, they spend it. So there's always two sides to a transaction. And as a result, spending requires funds, but also spending provides funds for others. And the way that we represent this is in this basic sources and uses framework, which is extremely useful for this environment. And that is that you've got three sources of funds available for spending, and you've got three places where that those funds can go. They can go into spending on goods and services, they can go into spending on financial assets, or they can find their way into cash reserves at a central bank. Now, importantly, sources of funds are required to provide those uses, but also the uses of fund provide sources. So for example, when one person spends, that produces income, which is sources for that person to then go spend. And that's what creates the self-reinforcing processes of an economic system. Now, recessions normally occur due to a tightening of monetary policy through a rise in interest rates. And the way that that plays out in terms of sources and uses is you get a rise in interest rates, which causes a reduction in borrowing over here on the left-hand side. The reduction in borrowing or credit then necessitates a reduction in spending over here on the right-hand side, which could either be less spending on goods and services or less purchases of financial assets. That's normally what causes a downturn. And the way you get out of that downturn is that you then cut interest rates. And as you cut interest rates, you expand credit, more borrowing, let's say housing or autos, and then produces spending. Spending over here on the right-hand side, which produces income for somebody, which produces spending. And you get this, what I refer to as a flywheel turning. The flywheel is the self-reinforcing process that goes on between spending and income, income and spending, and round she goes. Now, this downturn is unique because it has been caused by a collapse in income as people have just stopped working and producing. It was not caused by a tightening of monetary policy and a reduction in credit. It was not caused by any kind of a deleveraging. It was literally just income fell. And when income fell, spending fell. And it's a very unusual downturn for that reason.
You talk about the economic flywheel, but let's discuss more about the role fiscal and monetary policy will play as it pertains to getting that flywheel turning.
So first of all, fiscal policy. What fiscal policy is replacing lost income? Importantly, it's not replacing lost spending. It's replacing income. And so there are the government is taking direct actions with direct effects, but then hoped for indirect effects. So I've taken the sources and uses and given you sort of a 1, 2, 3 so that you can see the sequence of events as they occur and are hoped to occur. But in step one, the government borrows money with the intention that that will replace lost income. And so here you have an increase in credit by the government. And first step, the direct effect is that they're sending checks over here to augment lost income. Okay, that will work. Just send out the checks. Now you have the question of inefficiency. It may get to the wrong places. Nonetheless, as we see it, the total amount of money that's getting sent out is about roughly the total amount of money that was lost in the form of the income, at least in the aggregate. Now, the thing you're hoping for is how much of that will be spent versus saved or used for debt reduction. The next step is what you really want is that income to get spent. So will that spending then turn around here and produce income, and which turns the flywheel, which then produces spending? The risk is that that doesn't happen. The risk is that the government produces income, sends the checks out, it augments the income, but people don't spend it. Maybe they put it in cash over here in reserves, or maybe they use it to pay down their debts and have a reduction in debt here, offsetting the government expansion. In either one of those cases, you don't get the spending that the government is hoping for. And so that gap is a key gap to traverse for these policies to work. And when you look at surveys, for example, some surveys indicate that people intend to spend maybe half or less than half of the money that they're getting. That the other half they're looking to use for these other purposes, either saving it or debt reduction. If that was to occur, the government really needs to send out $2 for every $1 of income hole. So that's the first uncertainty related to the policy actions. The second thing that's happening is monetary policy is supporting fiscal policy and the markets. Once again, not producing income nor spending directly. So step one, the central bank prints money and they buy government bonds and a few other assets, but importantly, they don't buy all assets. So in the diagram, we print the money goes over and purchases financial assets, particularly bonds. The question then becomes, how much of that money that, so now the people that had bonds have cash. How much of that cash is going to find its way over here to spending to produce the necessary income to turn the flywheel? Looking back at past QE, it's a relatively small fraction. And so that means you actually have to print multiples amount of money and buy multiples amount of bonds to get the desired amount of that money flowing over to spending and income. And it's a highly uncertain amount. The second thing is you don't know that the money going into bonds is going to be then go into the stock market, or you don't know that it's going into the assets that the Fed is not buying. So that's another uncertainty. So they have to print way more than what's needed in order for a fraction of it to find its way into those desired places. And in the meantime, the extra finds its way over into cash reserves. So these are the two big uncertainties. How much will be reinvested in other assets versus accumulated as cash reserves? Will those funds be spent turning the flywheel? And if I could just give you a contrast that with, let's say, FDR in the 30s and something like the WPA, that's a different path. In that path, you can print the money. The government can borrow the money. And if the government is literally hiring people and literally buying things, then the government is actually doing the spending, and they're much more reliably going to get the spending that they want, which will then produce the income, which will then turn the flywheel. That form of fiscal stimulation has less dependencies than the one that we're operating with right now. Of course, it's a very difficult path to actually implement.
Bob, you've discussed some of the impacts of the virus on the economy as a whole, but we've also written about how the virus is going to hit different players in different ways. Can you say more about that?
So one of the key characteristics or key influences on this income shock is that it has a different degrees of impact on different entities. What I did was I took variations in the unemployment rate as a proxy for income and looked at how much did that affect spending in different types of sectors of the economy and how much does that flow through to earnings. And so what you see is that, let's say, for example, here is something like airline travel or auto parts, very big impacts. And if you run a 10% unemployment rate through those, you get massive declines in earnings, virtually down to zero or losses. On the other hand, hotels and durables is somewhere in the middle. Food and drug purchases and personal care, shampoo and soap is a lot less. Now, so if I take this sort of relationship, and I look at what would a 5, 10, 15, 20% unemployment rate mean for earnings, and this is what you're looking at. Let's say for a 10% unemployment rate, you have 80, 85% declines in earnings in some sectors and 10% declines in other sectors. Massive disparities. Then if you overlay that onto differences in indebtedness and cash flow and cash position, you get companies going to zero and you get bankruptcies in some areas and you get some hardly affected in other areas. Massive differences. Now, those are the cut-through approaches, just applying just kind of a simple approach on employment rate. But what we've really done here is that we've built out the capability to go top to bottom, bottom to top, to literally every single company, its particular cost structure, its revenue susceptibility to that environment, its debt service payments, and so forth, and simulated one company at a time, over time, what its impact on earnings cash flows will be, and then aggregated that up to the country level. We've shared this before, but we estimate roughly a $20 trillion fall in income globally as a result of this. That's the size of the hole that needs to be filled by the policies in the way that I've just described.
Bob, you've been looking at stable cash flows, basic staples, and how they can be relevant in a future where interest rates are close to zero. Can you share more with us on that?
Just as some industry groups will be massively affected, others won't be nearly as affected at all. So if you're talking about bacon and eggs, fruits and vegetables, and aspirin, you know, those things are going to get bought pretty much no matter what. And so one of the things that we've done is to think through how we might create a bond alternative. Given that interest rates are zero, how do you create an earnings stream from equities that might look something like the coupon on a bond over time? And if you, as it turns out, if you go to those kinds of spending, you know, bacon and eggs, fruits and vegetables, aspirin, tea, coffee, you know, those everyday things, also things like sugar and toys, those things, you know, have a very steady path of spending associated with them. And the companies that provide those kinds of goods and services tend to have a pretty steady stream of earnings. They're not very exciting, but they tend to go up over time, and they're maybe a little bit more exciting than bonds, but not a lot. So this red line here is the accumulation of the earnings of that type of company. And of course, the actual companies that existed at every point in time is changing. But in aggregate, if you look at them, the cash flow stream from that type of company, it tends to be a fairly steadily up climbing accumulation of cash flows, which gives you the possibility of creating something like a new asset class that could potentially be a bond alternative. And this is something that we're playing around with. That's here in relation to the overall earnings of the equity market, which you can see in blue, and that's for the United States. Take the same process across countries, and you see a very similar effect across other economies. So this is just another thing that we're building out from our research.
Bob, as always, thank you for your time.